Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA. I'm Lauren Silverman, sitting in for Chris Boyd. That, of course, is the theme song of March Madness, which officially kicks off tonight with two games in Dayton, Ohio. For the next 3 weeks, millions of Americans will be wearing college jerseys to work. You've probably seen them already, slaving over brackets and office bets, cheering and screaming in front of their TVs and tablet screens. The men's and women's basketball tournaments are run by the NCAA. It's an organization my next guest argues functions much like a cartel, exploiting college athletes across the country. Sports business columnist Joan O'Sara is co-author of a new book. It's called Indentured, The Inside Story of the Rebellion Against the NCAA. Joe, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me.
So, Joe, I was interested to find out that one of the early critics of the modern NCAA was actually from North Texas, an athlete named Gary Shaw. Tell me about him.
He was a trailblazer. In those days, people didn't really think much about what was wrong with college sports, whether the players were exploited or not. And he, after playing at the University of Texas, wound up writing the first book, really, that basically said, this system is bad for athletes and it's exploitative and it's wrong. And by the way, nobody listened.
And the title of his book caught my attention, too. Was it called Meat on the Hoof?
Yeah. Well, you think of movies like North Dallas 40, and there were a handful of movies that had, moderately similar titles around then, but they revolved around pro athletes. And this was one about college athletes, which, to do that in Texas, my God, football is king. Football is God. Nothing more reigns supreme. And so, it took a lot of guts.
And his story, though, really, you said no one paid attention to the book or no one read it. His story didn't end well, though, either.
No, it didn't. And I'm trying to remember why.
Well, what you said was he, and this was a guy from Denton. He went to Denton High School in the 60s, which is not too far from us here in Dallas. Got a scholarship to play with at UT. And he ended up becoming homeless with serious mental illness.
Yeah. He may have been an early person with CT. I think if he was examined today, he would have been found with CTE. CTE is a brain disease that has, recently come to the fore. But the truth is that, boxers and football players and the occasional hockey player, this has been going on for decades. And Gary Shaw, had sort of the classic symptoms where they kind of lose all reason and they get angry and they stop functioning in society. And there have been a surprising number of ex-football players who wind up homeless before they die and turn out to have CTE.
Yeah, he died at the age of 53. But in any case, so he was one of the first critics of the NCAA. But zoom out for a minute for me. Tell me what was the NCAA's role in the 70s when he first wrote that book?
Well, the NCAA became powerful in the 1950s. It actually had existed since about 1905 or 1906, but it had been toothless. There were a lot of people in college sports, especially in the Big Ten, who were worried about, recruiting, scholarships, which then were supposed to be banned, just sort of viewing college sports as having gotten out of control. So they put this guy in charge of the NCAA named Walter Byers. He was 29 years old. And within 5 or 6 years, he had turned the NCAA into an enormously powerful organization that ruled over enforcement of rules and also over television revenue for college football, which went away in the 80s. But the point is that it was a tremendously powerful organization that basically controlled the actions of college athletes who were unpaid and you know, it was a much tougher – the 1970s were much tougher for college athletes because, you know, there were no rules about concussions. Coaches could pretty much do anything they want. They could run players off that they didn't want, so you'd lose your scholarship, which doesn't happen nearly as much anymore. It was just it was hard to be a college athlete, especially if you weren't one of the 5% who were going to go professional. And so I would say – and there was also no due process. There were no rights. The NCAA could be a very vengeful organization. If you said anything to criticize them, they would open up an investigation. They did some really awful things in the 1970s that are almost hard to believe. One player we note in the book, lost a scholarship because he had gotten a $12 discount on two shirts at a retail store in Mississippi.
And it was a
somewhere.
Discount he didn't even know about, right?
Right, right. I mean, this is another thing. I mean, the number of times the NCAA has punished players for things they don't know about is kind of unbelievable. You know, we tell a story in the book about Perry Jones III, a freshman at Baylor whose mother had a heart condition, couldn't work, borrowed money from his coach when he was in high school, which she, by the way, paid back, and he was suspended for 5 games. It's just, you can't even describe how unbelievable that is.
Okay, let's get to the more of these enforcement stories in a second, but you mentioned that that Walter Byers transformed the NCAA. How did he do that?
Well, he had gotten the job because there were a lot of people in college sports who thought things were out of control. So the first thing he did was he persuaded every school in the country to not play Kentucky for a year in basketball, because Kentucky had been involved in a point-shaving scandal. And in so doing, it was basically the first enforcement action. So he proved that the NCAA could punish a university in that by doing that. And from that grew rules about recruiting, rules about what athletes could and could not do, all of which came under the rubric of NCAA enforcement. So that was one source of power. A second source of power was that he basically pushed aside any organization that competed with the NCAA and made the NCAA the only entity that you had to be a part of if you wanted to play, if you wanted to have a college sports program at your university. So when he started, they had a couple of hundred members. And when he ended in the 80s, they had over 1,000 members. So that was a second source of power. A third source of power was money. March Madness was not what it is today. In fact, it was on tape delay. It wasn't even that big a deal. But the real money was in college football, which, by the way, has always been the case. And from the early 50s until 1984, the NCAA controlled college football revenue. So that was yet another source of power. It meted out, you may remember, probably before your time, but I remember that, a big-time college program could only be on television twice a year, once in a national game, once in a regional game, which was infuriating if you were Oklahoma or Texas or Notre Dame USC, Southern Cal. And they eventually sued, and they got that overturned by the Supreme Court in 1984. But by then, the NCAA was so entrenched and so powerful that even the loss of that television revenue didn't diminish its power all that much.
And so you pointed out those two, but he also invented the idea of the student athlete. What did that mean?
Oh, boy, did he ever. So that happened in about 1956. And the reason he did that was because several states were considering allowing injured players, seriously injured players, to get workers' compensation because they came under the – they really, you know, if you had the definition of an employee, they met that definition. So he put out a memo to everyone in college sports and basically said, we have this new phrase, student athlete. You must use it all the time. Every time you talk about an athlete, you must use the phrase student athlete. And as that phrase became ingrained in the culture and ingrained in college sports, the whole idea that athletes were employees entitled to workers' comp went away, and that was the end of athletes getting workers' comp. I mean, it was done for an economic reason.
So What were the ways that the NCAA kept member schools in line? You mentioned convincing teams not to play against Kentucky for point shaving scandal. What else did they do?
Well, it kind of depends on what you mean by in line. you know, they had all these rules. You know, my line, as you said at the opening, is that the NCAA is a cartel. Well, all members of all cartels cheat. You know, the OPEC members cheat. You know, they sell more oil than they're supposed to, or they hold old oil back to jack up prices when they're not supposed to. And in college sports, cheating is called recruiting violations. That's what it's called. And so the NCAA has for a long time been in the business of trying to prevent schools from violating the rules around recruiting, some of which have to do with money, boosters and, you know, fake jobs and so on, some of which have to do with coaches, you know, how often they reach out to a recruit, what they do with the recruit, you know, how they treat the recruit. But, you know, it is a little like putting your finger in the dike. It's almost impossible to completely regulate. So then you get to the question of, who are they choosing to go after? And how hard are they choosing to go after them? And, you know, who gets punished and who doesn't get punished? And, you know, when Cam Newton's father was accused of trying to auction him off to an SEC school, the NCAA ruled that Cam Newton was not guilty of anything because he didn't know his dad was doing this. And it just so happened that Cam Newton was about to play in the high-profile big money Sugar Bowl, whereas other players in less high profile and, you know, with not as much money at stake get punished severely for something that's very similar. I mean, that's one of the problems with the NCAA, but it's also one of the things that both scared universities and infuriated universities, because they felt like they never knew when the NCAA was going to come after them and what they were going to do and whether the punishment fit the so-called crime.
At the very highest level of college sports, is it a joke to try and imagine the players as both athletes and students?
Yes. That's a little harsh, but for the most part, that's, you know. So universities make a bargain with athletes. And the bargain is, you come to our school, help us generate tens and hundreds of millions of dollars in revenue in football and men's basketball. You work 50 hours a week. You're in the weight room all the time. You have enforced study hall because that's the only time you have to study, 9 o'clock at night. You're up at 6 o'clock the next morning. You go on a road trip that'll last, you know, a week sometimes, especially now that the conferences are so spread apart, the conference teams are so spread apart. And in return, we will give you an education and a better life. Well, you know, the universities, by and large, especially in football and men's basketball, don't really keep up their end of the bargain. There are very few majors, legitimate majors, that an athlete can take that doesn't conflict with practice. And everybody knows practice comes first. There are many players who are unqualified for college work and who just get shunted from one easy class to another in order to keep them eligible. There are a lot of players, I like to call it majoring in eligibility. They take classes that have no particular rhyme or reason and that are just designed to keep them on the court for 4 years.
Let's talk a little bit more about the clash between academics and athletics in a minute. You're listening to Think on KERA. I'm Lauren Silverman, in for Chris Boyd. In this hour, we're talking with Joe Nocera about the book he's co-written, Indentured, The Inside Story of the Rebellion Against the NCAA. You can join our conversation by calling 800-933-5372 or by emailing think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Summer Youth Program with hands-on workshops in game design, coding, robotics, visual arts, math, and language arts for students entering grades K through 12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration is available at smu.edu/summeryouth.
You're listening to Think on KERA. I'm Lauren Silverman, in for Chris Boyd. This hour, we're talking with Joe Nocera. He's co-author of a new book, Indentured, the Inside Story of the Rebellion Against the NCAA. Joe, here in North Texas, SMU was in the top 25 for much of the season, and yet they're watching from home this weekend because they've been banned from the postseason for pressuring a Dallas high school to change a player's grades. The player's transferred, but the penalty still stands. How does this scenario play into your argument?
Well, I do think that the hardest part about the whole business of college sports is trying to square education with the fact that universities are fundamentally running a giant giant entertainment complex, you know, out of their athletic departments. You know, that's one of the things that's problematic about the system is universities really aren't set up to do this, and yet here we are. And way, way, way too many of the players are really not qualified academically, and yet the NCAA stresses over and over and over that they're really that academics comes first and sports is supposed to come second, which everybody knows is baloney. So, you know, in this particular case, this sort of thing happens all the time where, you know, a tutor helps a player more than he or she should, or a coach or an academic counselor takes a test for a player, or somebody takes a player's SAT, or somebody tries to get a high school transcript changed. It just speaks to how fundamentally corrupt so much of this is, and why we'd be so much better served if we have if we had a different system like they have in hockey and baseball, where when you get out of high school, you can make a truly legitimate choice whether to go professional in the minor leagues or whether to go to college. And if you enter college from baseball or hockey and you choose not to go into the minor leagues, you basically have to stay in school for 3 years before you can get drafted. That's so much a better system because then the ones who want to go to college are people who really want to go to college. In basketball and football, you don't have that choice because there is no minor league. So you have no choice but to go to college whether you're prepared or not, or whether it's something you want to do or not. So the idea that all these college football players are willingly going to college because they want to get an education, and oh, by the way, they'll play a little football on the side, it's just not real.
So you aren't the first person to stand up to the NCAA, and you outline the history of some of the people who did early on raise complaints. And they weren't the people you might expect. They were academics.
Well, I'm not quite sure who you're talking about. You're talking about Andy Schwartz and Dan Rasher?
Exactly, yeah.
Right. Okay, so, yeah, he and Dan Rasher and another guy named Ernie Nadell, who are economists working for a litigation consulting firm, you know, basically view the world through the prism of free market economics. And they got interested in the NCAA, and they came to see it completely through the lens of antitrust. And if you look at the NCAA through the lens of antitrust, then you just think this is one giant – everything they do is a giant antitrust violation. I'll give you a simple example, the so-called transfer rule, where if a player is a sophomore and wants to transfer to a different school, unless he can get a waiver from his coach in the NCAA, he has to sit out a year and lose a year of eligibility. And so by the time he's a senior, he only has 1 year left. If that's not a restraint of trade, I don't know what is. They would never do that to a coach because a coach would sue and would win in a nanosecond. And from Schwartz's and Rasher's point of view, the fact that the NCAA set compensation, and that's what they're doing, they're setting compensation for college athletes, also seems like an antitrust violation. I mean, you know, it's allegedly voluntary organization. That's supposed to provide, you know, championships and a competitive balance in college sports. And instead, they're basically a cartel that suppresses the labor force, that suppresses the wages of the labor force. So they found this from an intellectual point of view wrong. And they decided that they wanted to find somebody who would litigate this and would ask the court to declare it an antitrust violation, as the courts have periodically done when adults, when coaches or universities have sued the NCAA. And they went on basically a 15-year quest to do this that culminated with the famous O'Bannon case that was decided a few years ago, in which the NCAA was found to be a violation of the antitrust laws. But then the judges and then the appeals court didn't have the nerve to take the next step, which was to say if the rules are against the law, you have to get rid of the rules. Everybody was too afraid of what might happen if they blew up the system.
So you paint a picture in the book of the student-athlete as stuck in this sort of limbo in an industry that's valued upward of $13 billion, and yet they're not allowed to earn free market salaries. They don't have long-term health insurance oftentimes and disability benefits. Why don't more of them complain?
Well, because they're 18 and 19. That's why. And because they are excited about being in college and about playing in front of millions of people. And because, most of all, because they all think, even the guys on the bench, think they're going to be professional. So they don't want to rock the boat. They don't want to get a bad reputation. And then there's the pressure. There's a chapter in the book about the effort to unionize the Northwestern football team, which fundamentally failed. But the most interesting part about that, which was written by my co-author Ben Strauss, was the pressure that was put on the players once this union drive became public. It was really not unlike what happens when employees at any company try to unionize. So in this case, there was pressure from the coach, who basically viewed this as a betrayal. There's pressure from the universities. There's pressure from the alumni network. And they're basically saying, if you guys have a union, you will never get a job through the Northwestern alumni network. It just won't happen. And it's really hard to stand up to that kind of pressure. And I think it's unrealistic to think that that 18- and 19-year-old athletes will stand up to that kind of pressure. I will say, however, if you let me one more sentence. The Missouri football players last fall, when they said they would go on strike over racial incidents at the university and caused the president to resign within 36 hours, shows you, in fact, how much power the athletes actually have if they could bring themselves to use it.
So you think that it's really a problem of organization, not that they're powerless?
They're definitely not powerless. If look, if we have the Final Four in 3 weeks and one of the teams doesn't come out to play, you change the system in an hour. I mean, come on. You know, with all that money at stake, with all those people watching, nobody's going to call off the games. They're going to go into the players and say, what do you want?
Now, someone who has tried to help organize these student athletes is Ramoji Humah, who's written about in your book. And we have a clip of him here speaking in 2013.
I think for those people watching the coaches' salaries explode, you know, the athletic directors and colleges turn this into a big business. I think for those people, they should focus on what's already happened. Players being able to sell their bowl rings or do a commercial on the side. You know, the Olympics did it for years. You know, they allowed international amateurs to go ahead and get endorsements and fund themselves. It was the international definition of amateurism. The NCAA's version is much more self-serving. Everything is pro except for what the players get.
That was Humah discussing the economics of the NCAA in 2013. Joe, you say that a lot of the rules in the NCAA are particularly hard on younger, poorer, black athletes. How so?
Well, the rules are about money. And they're about you can't have money. You can't get money through your athletic skills or even tangentially because you're an athlete. So does this harm the typical middle-class white kid who has money in his pocket and whose parents can get on a flight to go to the recruiting visit when he is flown to a school to recruit? No, it does not. It does not. Does it affect the poor black family in a disadvantaged neighborhood who where there's a single mom raising four kids and who does not have the money to do that? Yes, it does. And further, the NCAA is deeply suspicious of much that goes on in African-American basketball high school subcultures, particularly the AAU. They think that, sleazy, agents are trying to steer players here and there, and that sleazy AAU coaches are taking money on the side, and, when players have benefactors, there's something wrong there, and it has to be investigated. And there's just a general suspicion that causes, every year to be a bunch of eligibility issues. When's the last time, by the way, at the beginning of a football or a basketball season, that you saw a white player being held out on eligibility questions because there are questions about their academics or whether they took money or this or that? When is the last time you saw that happen to a white player?
Some of the investigations that the NCAA conducts are really shocking. And one story that stands out, you write about, is the story of a basketball player, Ryan Boatwright, and his mom in 2011. Tell me about that one.
Well, I stumbled onto that case 4-plus years ago, and it really I was so angered by it. It actually propelled a lot of my further columns, which got me to write this book. That was kind of a central incident in my own thinking. Ryan Boatwright was a classic example of a young, poor black athlete who the NCAA would not make eligible. He was a freshman at UConn. And the reason was that his mother had done exactly what I just said. She had taken money from a friend who was also Boatwright's coach to visit the universities that were recruiting him, which you would think would be a good thing, not a bad thing, right? And then what ensued was an investigation that I just thought was beyond the pale, where, they hold her up in a hotel for 5 hours, wouldn't even let her call out to her parents who had taken care of the other kids. They would knock on her door at work. They would call her. She wound up losing her job. She wound up suffering depression. They wanted to see every check she had written for the last 3 or 4 years. They went to other people's places of work to say, did you write this check for such and such a reason? She had to basically account for every penny. And there was this enormous degree of humiliation on top of all this. When these guys show up at her office in their ties and their raincoats like they're in the FBI or something, or that she sees the scrawl on ESPN that says her son is being held out because she's under investigation. I just found it to be so profoundly un-American. This lack of due process, this lack of rights, this lack of respect, this lack of compassion, that it just felt wrong to me. And then the more I learned about the NCAA, the more I realized that this was not an aberration. This is fundamentally how it operates.
So what are some of the arguments for the NCAA? What do they say in response?
Well, they run a good championship. Not just in basketball. I mean, they are a useful organizing vehicle. What they say is that the essence of college sports is amateurism. That if you started to pay the players or you started to give them a lot more, you would destroy what is pure and good about college sports. People would stop going. I don't really believe that's true at all. I don't think people care one way or the other if the players get paid some money. I really don't. I think the essence of college sports is that people want to know that the players that they're rooting for are, in some way, shape, or form, enrolled as students in the university. That's why I would never advocate having eligibility more than 4 years, because 4 years is the normal length of college.
These days, it's often 5 or 6.
Well, that's true. Yeah. And I also believe, by the way, one of my remedies is there should be lifetime scholarships. But we can get into that in a minute. So their essential argument is that, yes, everything else is professionalized about college sports, as Ramoghi had said in that clip that you played, but the athletes need to remain unpaid for college sports to be college sports.
Now, the NCAA also says that the vast majority of money it brings in goes back into the schools. Is that supports other sports teams that are less popular. Do you accept that argument at all?
Well, the NCAA does distribute a lot of money to the schools. That's true. It also keeps a lot of money for itself. Much of that money goes to pay coaches who make millions of dollars, conference commissioners make millions of dollars. Athletic directors make millions of dollars. 45, 50, 100, $200 million facilities get built, you know, indoor practice facilities for the football team. But there's a second issue also, which is that they argue that the revenue sports of football and men's basketball support everything else that support all the other sports in a university's
like
athletic.
Like lacrosse or women's soccer.
Yes, that's right. But to me, you know, if the university values lacrosse, it should pay for lacrosse. Just as if it values a history department, it pays for a history department. Why should disadvantaged black kids playing football subsidize upper middle class white kids playing lacrosse? I don't understand why that's right.
And one complaint you hear a lot from higher profile college athletes is that, you know, they go onto on campus and they see a jersey for sale with their name and number on it, and then they don't see a penny of that sale.
That's very true. And they should. They should. I actually believe that all athletes, not just football and basketball players, Ramogi also mentioned the Olympic model. The Olympic model basically says you don't get paid for playing the sport, but any outside income from endorsements, from signing your name, from autographs, from sponsorships is fine. And, you know, I think, you know, it would seem like I don't even see what the problem would be in allowing college athletes to do that.
You're listening to Think on KERA. I'm Lauren Silverman, in today for Chris Boyd. This hour, does the NCAA exploit college athletes? That's the argument Joe Nocera makes in a new book he's co-authored. What do you think? You can join our conversation. Call 800-933-5372. We'll get to some of your calls in just a minute. You can also email think@kera.org or send me a tweet. I'm at L Silverwoman. We'll be back with more from Joe Nocera in a moment.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Summer Youth Program with hands-on workshops in game design, coding, robotics, visual arts, math, and language arts for students entering grades K through 12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration is available at smu.edu/summeryouth.
You're listening to Think. I'm Lauren Silverman, in this week for Chris Boyd. We're talking about the exploitation of college athletes. That's how Joe Nocera puts it in a new book he's co-authored about the NCAA. It's called Indentured, the Inside Story of the Rebellion Against the NCAA. Joe, so many people get so much joy out of the NCAA tournament. My editor here calls it the most wonderful time of year. What do you say to them?
I don't disagree. I grew up in Providence, Rhode Island, rooting for the Providence College Friars, which were the only game in town. I'm thrilled that they're a ninth seed this year in the tournament. They're back. So, yeah, I'm going to root. Heck yeah, I'm going to root. I love college sports. I think, you know, I'm not one of those people who say you shouldn't watch or you shouldn't enjoy. Mm-hmm. But I am one of those people, I basically say you should be aware that the players on the floor are being exploited. There was an interesting moment a few years ago when Louisville was in the Final Four, and one of their star players broke his leg in a very, very horrible way during the game. And it's the first time I can ever remember the sports press openly asking the question, what's going to happen to him at the university? Will he get to keep his scholarship? Will the university take care of him after he graduates medically if the leg still has problems? And I thought to myself, boy, this is a real change in the way we think about these athletes, because as recently as 5 years ago, those questions would not have been asked. So, you know, my hope is that as we progress, as people keep thinking about this and talking about this, that there will be a further sort of, I hate to use the phrase consciousness raising, but consciousness raising. And that people will continue to ask questions about why the system operates the way it does.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I just wanted to point out, you know, a lot of the fans don't like my set of ideas, and I understand that. And they think things are just fine the way they are, and the players should be happy. But I remember Major League Baseball and free agency and how the fans were totally aligned with the owners, who said that free agency would wreck baseball. And, you know, Marvin Miller, who was the union head at the time, was, you know, going to destroy the sport, and the players were greedy and so on and so forth. And now, you know, free agency has not hurt baseball. It's probably enhanced baseball. And the players make tons of money. But by the way, so do the owners.
Interesting. Yeah. Let's go to one of the questions on the phone now. Let's go to Matt in Plano.
Good afternoon. Great discussion. You mentioned Northwestern earlier, but I wanted to ask about the case that ultimately ruled against them. Why were they not allowed to unionize? Because, I mean, we have the First Amendment that says you can petition, you can organize. Shouldn't they have a voice over the student-athlete agreement that they're signing, and so they're not worried about being, you know, locked into one-year scholarships every year? Like you said, if a player gets injured, they can revoke their scholarship. I mean, why did the courts rule against Northwestern students?
Well, first of all, it wasn't the courts. It was the National Labor Relations Board. Let me answer your question on two levels. One of the real problems with the system is that the athletes have no voice. They have no power. They have no way to push back in an organized fashion. They're not even allowed to have agents, as you know, when they're in college. So they don't even have an individual who can advocate on their behalf. You know, so many times an athlete will get in trouble with the NCAA, and the university will say, well, you don't need a lawyer. You know, they do need a lawyer. To answer your specific question, I actually think this is one of the more shameful acts by the National Labor Relations Board, certainly in the Obama administration and maybe many years before. The hearing was held in Chicago by the NLRB, and the Chicago director of the NLRB, after 3 or 4 days of testimony, ruled that the players certainly qualified as employees and therefore should have the right to unionize. The Northwestern appealed, and the NLRB in Washington, the five members, they just punted. They just punted. Mm. They didn't say yes. They didn't say no. They said, well, you know, we just don't want to get involved in this. You know, and they actually said a few things about competitive balance, which was ridiculous. This is part of the problem. When it's an adult, you know, the assistant coaches once sued, saying that the NCAA didn't have the right to restrain their pay. And they won. It's obviously a restraint of trade. The NCAA has no right to restrain the pay of coaches. But when it's the athletes, when it's the 18 and 19-year-olds, the courts, the government bodies, the Congress, they have a hard time applying the same standard to 18 and 19-year-olds as they do to adults. And they're basically willing to say, we're going to allow this paternalistic system to exist that exploits these players because we're worried that we'll wreck college sports if we do it any other way. I mean, I think it's shameful, but that's me.
So there's a real fear of getting involved as well by people whose names are going to be out there.
Very much so. You know, Congress won't touch this with a 10-foot pole. Unless the NCAA asked it, I mean, it seems plausible to me that if the courts were to rule against the NCAA, I could totally see them going to Congress asking for an antitrust exemption and putting pressure on university presidents, athletic directors, and coaches to petition the congressmen to pass a bill that would do that, and it probably would pass.
You can join our conversation by emailing think@kera.org, or you can call 800-933-5372. Let's go to another caller. Let's go to Kyle in Dallas. Hi, Kyle.
Hi, how's it going?
Great.
All right. Well, I really like this show. It's a really good conversation. My dad is actually an athletic trainer for an NCAA football team. It's a D1. We just recently went D1. And what I noticed at the school was a bit different from what's being explained here about the exploitation of athletes. I feel that exploitation has a very negative connotation. I think most of the athletes were very happy. We saw that our school's enrollment increased significantly because we brought, well, I believe it was attributed to bringing in a football program and moving into D1. And obviously I get a little bit of bias from my dad because he also thinks that, you know, student athletes benefit actually more under this type of system as opposed to being considered an employee. I'm kind of wondering about the whole argument regarding the, if we consider these students, athletes, employees, that's fine. There's a lot of student, there was a comment made earlier, and I know I'm trying not to get off track here, but a comment was made earlier about how a lot of these students, some of them aren't even meant to be in school. They go to school and they're really just there because of their student scholarship. But I would make that argument that that's a lot of students in school right now. We have some of the highest graduation rates for college degrees that we've ever had. And at the same time, we're having a lot of students are struggling with either their degree choice outside of them being student athletes. And so I'm kind of wondering about that. Maybe this sport in the school, they bring so much revenue that it allows the school to function better, and it allows the education to be better. Maybe there's a trickle-down effect there. And I know you're arguing the opposite, but I'm kind of curious on your thoughts about that.
Well, I'm not completely arguing the opposite. We haven't really talked about the benefits to a university of having a football or a basketball team that's successful, and the benefits are considerable. I agree with you that it often increases admissions. It allows a school to be more selective. It is a great source of pride. There's no question it has benefits. It allows a university to have a larger national reputation than it might otherwise. Would Notre Dame be viewed as one of the great universities in the country if it didn't have the reputation as the greatest, as the great football power of you know, the last 50 years? Probably not. So I don't disagree with that at all, but I would say that's all the more reason why the football players and the men's basketball players deserve some financial reward for all that they're doing for the university.
What type of salary arrangement do you think college athletes should have? How might it look?
Okay. I think there's two ways to do this. The Andy Schwartz, Dan Rashaway, who we spoke about earlier,
the economist,
is basically right. Yeah. So their view is that the NCAA is not the appropriate unit to be setting compensation, but the conferences are. So they would have the conferences basically compete for athletes on the basis of compensation. You know, the Big Ten might want to offer more money than the SEC. Or, I mean, some of that's happening now, I might add, because and this is a little sidetrack, but it's worth it. Alabama, you know, they now allow athletes to get what's called the full cost of attendance, which is the difference between a scholarship and what it actually costs to go to school. This is widely viewed to be between $2,000 and $3,000 a year. Well, Alabama's cost of attendance now is over $6,000. Hmm. You don't think they're using that as a recruiting tool? Of course they are. My scheme would be to have a salary cap. And my idea is that every player would have a minimum salary. Every football and men's basketball player would have a minimum salary of $25,000, which is not enough to make them rich, but allows them to be treated the same way as any other kid on campus. And that you would still have money left over, half the cap, to use money as a recruiting tool. And this is the part that people really have a hard time getting their head around, because they think, how can you do that? How can you use money as a recruiting tool? How can you offer a player $40,000 or $50,000 a year to come to your school? My answer to that is students use money as part of their decision-making process to go to school all the time. All the time. A parent says, I can't afford for you to go to Berkeley, so you have to go to some other state school. I went to Boston University because they offered me the largest scholarship amount. That was the reason I went to that school.
Of course.
So why is it so horrible if you say, well, we should do this for athletes? I would make a further argument, which is that so much of this so-called slimy stuff that happens under the table would go away if the money was on the table instead of under the table. And all the sweet talking of the coaches, you know, a lot of that would go away because you'd have a much more straightforward transaction, and this coach wouldn't be giving you a bunch of BS.
So they'll legalize it. They'll legalize it, bring it out of the shadows.
Right. And then there's a third rationale. They spend, schools spend literally hundreds of millions of dollars building state-of-the-art facilities that are in no small part an effort to attract the best recruits. Hundreds of millions of dollars. Think of how much cheaper it would be if you spent some of that money on the athletes themselves.
Has your idea, what you've laid out just now, has it gained any traction? Who's willing to listen to you? Well, I mean, the whole audience.
I don't know. That's such a depressing question.
Oh, no.
Here's what's happened. When I started writing about this 5 years ago in the New York Times, there were a few lonely voices that didn't get much of a hearing. And then Taylor Branch wrote a seminal article in The Atlantic in September of 2010, I think it was, that really laid out some of this and actually called the NCAA, said it had the whiff of the plantation.
Yes.
It was a very powerful, important story. And then I started writing about it the following January, and then I kept writing about it for the next 2 or 3 years. And in the meantime, and I can't give myself all this credit, but a bunch of other sort of sports writers and thinkers began to take up the cry, and they began to get a larger hearing. And so we got to the point where instead of everybody accepting the NCAA's rationale, there were a lot more people questioning it. Are we at the point where, you know, the majority of fans and officials and everybody looking at the NCAA buys my set of ideas about certainly about paying? No. But I think others of my ideas and the ideas of others, like lifetime scholarships, like lifetime health care, like, you know, some of it's actually even happened. More and more schools now are offering 4-year scholarships instead of 1-year scholarships. The NCAA itself now allows a player who's injured, badly injured and can't play anymore, to keep the scholarship. And then they allow the university, the team, to get another scholarship to make up for that player who can't play anymore. That didn't always used to happen. So that, you know, there are changes on the margins that are making things better. But at the same time, the powers that be are totally opposed to the sort of more radical ideas that I have about pay and so forth.
But you'll still try and dish them out, which is fun to hear.
Well, that's what I do. You know, I plant the flag on a cause, and I kind of make it a bit of a crusade. And I really got passionate on this subject and couldn't let it go.
Joe Nocera is co-author of a new book. It's called Indentured, The Inside Story of the Rebellion Against the NCAA. Joe, thank you so much for your time.
It was a real pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker. It's engineered by Shelley Canavy, with help on the phones from Kristen Taylor. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington, and you can contact us via email, think@kera.org. Thanks for listening. Have a wonderful day and enjoy March Madness.